योगेन चित्तस्यपदेन वाचां मलं शरीरस्य च वैद्येन योपाकरोत्तं प्रवरं मुनीनां पतञ्जलिं प्राञ्जलिरानतोऽस्मि स्तुवे पतञ्जलिं व्यासं शङ्करं च मुनित्रयं कर्तृसूत्रस्य भाष्यस्य क्रमाद् विवरणस्य च So we were dealing with this 52nd sutra of the third chapter, and then the next one. So we'll complete this sutra, the 52nd. Sthani upanimantrane sangasmaya akaranam punaha anishta prasangat. So that is a sutra. The translation may not do full justice to the whole implication. So the meaning, the essential meaning is this, in simple words. When we practice yoga, the higher concentration, especially samyama, which is a combination of dharana, dhyana and samadhi, mind develops some special powers and skills, which if you do not look at the whole dynamics may appear to be miracles. They are really not miracles. What we call miracle is something that we cannot really explain in empirical terms from a purely logical point of view. But these skills can be explained. First of all, you should know that these skills are the result of samyama. And samyama means intense concentration on any subject or any area, any skill, any knowledge or anything. When we focus our whole mental and intellectual energy on something, then naturally we are able to go deeper into that particular either area of knowledge or skill through continuous practice at the mechanical level, physical level, or continuous concentration at the intellectual level. We are able to penetrate outer layers of knowledge, and that helps us to meditate. So from concentration to meditation, where we become mentally identified with the essence of what we meditate upon. Any area of knowledge, either literature, science, music, or even physical exercises, physical skills. If you intensely practice a physical skill for a long time, putting the whole mental energy on that particular skill, then after some time, we are able to penetrate into the deeper aspect of that skill. And if you continue that again for a long time, then we are able to go still deeper and we get an intuitive understanding of that particular skill or knowledge or anything. So that's why concentration, meditation and intuition. So these three mental exercises in an ascending order, we start with concentration, then we go to meditation, then we reach the intuition level. When we reach the intuition level, we get an insight, a special insight into whatever we meditate upon. This is what is happening to a great musician who spent years of intense concentration in musical practices or painting or anything. As I mentioned, even physical exercise, the great Olympic champions, the great physical artists They all reach the highest peak of perfection through what yoga calls samyama. So now it's very clear that there is no miracle and there is no accident in yoga practice. Yoga practice purely scientific. And from a rational point of view, you can very easily explain it in logical terms. Now, if you look at the translation of this particular sutra, we may find there is something mythological about it, which may appear to be somewhat irrational. So you look at the mantra, the meaning of this sutra, sthani upanimantrani. What it means is this: when you reach a skill, such special powers, supranatural powers, as we call in yoga, called vibhutayaha, I mean vibhuti, then what happens? Literal translation is this, but it should be taken only in a limited context. Great supernatural beings, celestial beings will come and invite you to enjoy worldly pleasures, making use of these special skills. This is the literal translation. So that needs some explanation. And the yoga and the sutra continues further. Sthani upanimantrani sangamasi akaranam. Then you know what happens? We should not feel allured or tempted when we are tempted into enjoying these powers of mind. And the reason is given, punaha anishta prasangad. Means, if you get lost or if you are tempted, then it leads to a very serious deviation in spiritual life. Such stories are very common in Hindu mythology, and in a different language it is put in the light of the theory of evil in the Christian mystical tradition, where the devil or the Satan or the archangel or the Beelzebub comes and tempts the saint to drag him away from the path of God. So these are anthropomorphic explanation of a purely psychological rational phenomenon. Vyasa gives a very wonderful, purely psychological description of this phenomenon. Punaha anishta prasangat. If you are tempted, if you are caught in this trap of attraction or temptation, then what happens? You lose your track. You are trying to put an end to this cyclic rotation of birth, life, death and rebirth, going through this misery of worldly existence, and you are seeking liberation, what you call nirvana, or as the cessation of this cyclic process. You are trying to realize your true nature, the fact that you are Atman, it is spiritual liberation, spiritual enlightenment. So these temptations will be a great danger for this liberation. Thinking of these, what you do? You block yourself mentally from being tempted by these temptations. This is the literal meaning. Now, Vyasa, in ancient times, you know, he gives a very, very rational interpretation. I already read some portion of this in the last class. So, Vyasa's commentary is Sanskrit. But though the commentary is in Sanskrit, I shall explain in elaborate terms with examples. So, even if you do not follow the Sanskrit commentary, you won't miss anything. So, Vyasa says, evam abhidhiyamanaha sankadoshan bhavayir ghoreshu samsara angareshu pachyamanena maya janana marana antakare vibharivartamanena kadanchit asadidaka ക്ലേശ തിമിര വിനാശോ യോഗ പ്രദീപക. ദിസ് ഈസ് വ്യാസസ് കമന്ററി. വാട്ട് വ്യാസ സേസ് ഈസ് ദിസ്: വെൻ യു ഗെറ്റ് ദീസ് സ്കിൽസ്, mental skills, you are able to do things which ordinary human beings are not able to do. So certainly there will be a tendency for making use of these powers for worldly pursuits. So it does happen, and it is still happening, and it has happened many times. If you look at the history of yoga, many of the spiritual cults, both those who came from India and also here, 20th century, you can see many examples where people, yogic teachers or spiritual teachers, practicing meditation and spiritual practices for some time, get special skills, so people get drawn towards them, and then they get completely lost in this whirlpool of temptations and get lost. It happens. So Vyasa says, when such temptations come, so Vyasa is again using the anthropomorphic language, evam abhidhiyamanaha, means when you are invited by angels or devas, a literal language, which means when the mind itself drags you, the mind, instead of taking you further in spiritual path, suddenly presents before you an alternate path. You have got all these skills. Why don't you make use of these skills to make more money, to become more famous, or to achieve worldly pleasures, to enjoy worldly pleasures? These are the backward pulling temptations of the mind, which is put in the language of mythology. Is called, you know, that is called evam abhidhiyamanaha, means devaihi abhidhiyanam, abhidhiyamanaha, means when angels invite you for all this. Then sangadoshan bhavayi, then think of the danger of associating with such worldly temptations. Think of the peril, the danger. To be very very frank, if you read many mythological books, Ramayana, Mahabharata, many things, you come across many stories, great spiritual aspirants who worked hard for long years, suddenly had a deviation, and then they became worldly minded. Then they had to take more and more births to get back to the real track and go continue the journey to a spiritual liberation. So there is a very, very striking illustration in the Bhagavata Purana, which in a way explains the whole phenomenon of this kind of deviation, which really happened to a great soul. So there was a great emperor. So his name was Bharata. And he was a very noble, highly reputed, an ideal king, an ideal emperor. So according to Kalidasa, who writes in the Raghuvamsa, he says, that king, that emperor is the ideal emperor, who looks upon the whole, all his subjects as his own children. That is, so all the wise men in his court as his elders and respected. So in a way, this King Bharata was such an ideal, noble king. So, you know, in those days, in ancient times, there was a tradition in India that great kings, emperors, or even ordinary householders, after leading householders' life, when they have their children, when the progeny, I mean the continuation of family tradition is guaranteed, when they see the face of the grandchildren, that's the idea behind, and when they find their face is getting wrinkled, the hair becoming gray, then instead of trying to whiten the teeth and blackening the hair, they should go and retire to a forest hermitage. Instead of trying to reverse the physical shape or color, whatever it is, they should retire. This is enough. No, we must spend the rest of our lifetime in meditation, contemplation. So Manusmriti, the great lawgiver of Vedic times, says, Grihastha Svyada Pashid Vali Palidam Atmanaha apatyasi apatyam tada aranyam samasi. The great lawgiver Manu, who wrote in the 3rd millennium BC, he says, an ideal householder, when he sees that his hair is getting gray, his face is getting wrinkled, that means he's getting old, and when he sees the face of his grandson or granddaughter, then he should retire to a forest hermitage with his wife and spend the rest of his lifetime in meditation and contemplation, thinking of God. This is what an ideal householder should do. That's true, especially true of great kings. So the Bharata was such an ideal king. So he became old. So he called his oldest son, Janamejaya, and made him the next king, heir apparent. And he left the palace, the kingdom, and went to a forest. He was alone by the time his wife also died. So he built a small hut in a thick forest, surrounded by trees, mountains, and also a stream. And there he lived for many years and spent all his lifetime in meditation and concentration. And then what happened, you know, after some time, something happened. One day, a deer was being chased by a lion. And as the deer ran away from the lion, it jumped across a narrow stream. And the lion chased the deer. It was pregnant, this deer. And out of fear, it reached the other bank of the stream by the time it gave birth to a baby deer, which fell in the water. And it was rotting in the water. The mother deer died, maybe due to the terrible effort and fear. Now, what will a king do? King was a very noble king, man of compassion. So he plunged into the river and saved the little baby deer. And this little animal grew up in the hermitage. The king looked after the poor animal with great affection, saving it, protecting that animal from wild animals like tigers and lions. Now, after some time, it was time for the king to die. He was too old. And as he was about to breathe his last, the little baby deer came to him moving about. So the king was very much worried about what was going to happen to this deer. So it may be caught by a wild animal, it may... So he was very much worried. With this worry in his mind and anxiety for the protection of the deer, he died. Now, there is an old tradition in Hindu scriptures. Whatever thought is uppermost in your mind when you die, when you are dying, when you are breathing your last, that thought will influence your next birth. And when a person dies, when they mind is weak, senses have become weak, then the natural thought currents which he has accumulated in his mind will come to the surface. So that would be the thought which will come in our mind when a person dies. So this king was worried about the protection of the baby deer, and he was focusing his mind on the deer, and he died. And he was born as a deer in the next life. Now look at the fate of this great king. He was a great philosopher, an ideal king, who left his own kingdom, his own family, his own comforts, his own kingly responsibilities, and left his palace, went to a forest, meditated for years, practicing total renunciation, practicing great austerities. And he left his palace to spend the rest of his lifetime meditating on God. And he died meditating on a deer. So he was born as a deer. Next slide. And what happened? But the deer had not forgotten its past. See, whatever little spiritual practice we do in this life, if you have sincerely practiced, if you listen to a great lecture with all sincerity and you have imbibed those thoughts, or if you meditated just once or prayed once, or thought some noble spiritual thoughts, that will create a spiritual capital, a spiritual bank balance in our mind, and that will help us when we are born again. So if there is a proper conducive opportunity, our mind will connect with these spiritual ideas because of the force of the influence of the samskaras, the vrittis, the impressions that we have already gathered in our life. So when he was born as a deer, it was still very contemplative. It did not join the herd of other animals. It spent all his lifetime in the same ashrama, in the same hermitage, without moving from there, and always in a contemplative mood. And it died. When it died, it was reborn as a great spiritual mystic. So it shows that even in the life of a great king who practically left his palace just to lead the life of a spiritual contemplative, forgot that goal, that purpose for some time, and while showing compassion to a poor animal, instead of showing that compassion with a kind of detachment, by keeping the mind on God, still showing compassion to the little animal deer, he replaced the idea of God with the form of the deer, and he had to leave this world, had to die with the thought of the deer in his mind, and had to be born as a deer in the next life. But then the good actions of the king in this life won't be lost. So though it was in the body of a deer or animal, still it continued the contemplative practice. And when that animal died, when the deer died, it focused its mind on God and was born as a mystic. It's called Jatabharata. You see, the story continues in the Bhagavata Purana. So what that means, if you are sincere in spiritual life, then if you are not always alert, we may be delayed by one or two births, not by one or two days. That's what it means. So that's why Vyasa says, evam abhidhiyamanaha sangadosan bhavayet. We should always think of the dangers of deviation from spiritual path. Ghoreshu samsara angareshu pachyamanena maya janana marana maranantagare vibridamanena kadanjit asaditaka. Then he says, this worldly life, now what is worldly life? We must explain this. It is not the life in which we do our duties and responsibilities. So the worldly life here is compared to a mighty blazing fire by the commentator Vyasa. We should not be like a piece of dry twig that is thrown into the mighty blazing fire. That is samsara angareshu means. Samsara means this, the cyclic rotation of being born, living, dying, again reborn. Life is unavoidable. Activities are unavoidable. Responsibilities and duties are unavoidable. But along with that, we should also keep our mind linked to a higher spiritual ideal. Even while living in this world, we can live in this world without being worldly minded. So, to avoid the problem of being worldly minded, we must keep in a corner of our heart a place for a higher spiritual ideal, place for God, place for spiritual practices. Then what happens? This world will not be a blazing fire. So Vyasa, ghoreshu samsara angareshu pachyamanena. We are being roasted. Otherwise, you know what happens? If you think money is the only purpose of life, material pleasures are only goal in human existence, then life becomes a blazing fire. And the person who thinks that worldly enjoyments are the only thing that matter in life become like little tiny twigs which are roasted in this blazing fire of worldliness or worldly mindedness. And then whether we be born, living, dying, and reborn, the cyclic rotation continues. So in the midst of all this, not that we should run away from duties and responsibilities, not that we should go away, we should withdraw, we should be negligent or indifferent towards our duties and responsibilities. That is not the meaning. The meaning is, in the midst of all this, we must keep our mind linked to a higher spiritual ideal. Then this world is not a blazing fire. So the commentator says, we should always think, if I do not have the spiritual ideal as my guide, then I am like a tiny twig or a fuel that's being burned, roasted in this mighty fire of worldly. I have started my practice for yoga. So you should remember, the first sutra in the yoga sutra is Atha Yoga Anishasanam. So already mentioned here. First sutra. Atha means now onwards, henceforth. When? So when do we turn to yoga? In a broader sense, when do we turn to spiritual life? So when we reach a point that, when we reach a point that makes us make a turn towards something higher, a higher positive turn for the mind. In the midst of all these obligations, duties, enjoyments, and compulsions, demands of worldly life, we also give importance to a priority to some higher spiritual value. And even while being engaged in our duties and responsibilities, we must keep our mind linked to a higher value. It is not running away from something, it is moving towards a higher goal. Blind rejection out of aversion or hatred, just running away from worldly duties and responsibilities, cannot take us to yoga. Actually, yoga helps us to sublimate what we normally call the compulsions or demands of worldly life. It helps us to take a higher perspective, a higher approach to the practical realities of everyday life and responsibilities. Not that we run away from something. Running away from something cannot take us to yoga. If you just run away from something, you'll be only vacuum. We may fall in a vacuum. Much more important is running towards a higher goal. So moving forward towards a higher goal is what is meant by Atha. And now onwards, we turn to yoga. We discuss yoga. That is the first sutra, the Samadhipada. So, when we reach that stage, what happens? Then we feel, well, the world is okay. Duties and responsibilities, compulsions, okay, fine. But life has got something higher too. Life has got a higher value as well. So, that opens a new door. That gives us a different priority, a different perspective. Not that, as you mentioned, not that we run away from the world of realities. Often, you know, yoga may be interpreted as a kind of life-negating, world-negating over-asceticism. So, very often when we read the Sanskrit scriptures, without reading the true interpretation of the great Sanskrit classical interpreters like Vyasa or Shankara or Vijnana Bhikshu and many others, you know, the great Sanskrit commentators who have written very, very rational, level-headed commentaries. On the other hand, there is also a tendency, yoga can be a means for improving worldly comforts. That is the other extreme. So, between these two extremes, the great classical writers have presented a very balanced view. I mean, Patanjali Yoga Sutras, interpreted by Vyasa, and again, Vyasa's commentary, further commented upon by Vijnana Bhikshu and many others, Shankaracharyas and others. So, that's why he says, Klesha Timira Vinasho Yoga Pratipaka. So, I have taken this move towards higher life, spiritual life, towards yoga. So I should not be trapped or duped by the temptations. The commentator continues, Tasya cha ede Krishna yoga yo vishayavayavaka pradipakshaka. Now the commentator, Vyasa, continues. See, I want liberation. So, I'm going for higher spiritual meaning, looking for another meaning in life. Now, if we allow ourselves to be tempted or duped or trapped by these special supernatural powers, what happens? It would be like a storm, a powerful wind or storm, putting out the light that is burning within us. So, if there is a lamp that is burning, if a wind blows, the lamp will be put out. Like that, desire for worldly comforts. If you make use of the special skills for worldly comforts, then what happens? It would be like putting out a lamp that is burning within us. And then Vyasa continues. Sakhalu aham labdha lokaha katham anaya vishaya magadushnaya vanchitaha. See, that's again, you know, we had so many lives in the past. So many times we have been born in this world. So we have enjoyed all these worldly comforts. In this life, we got a chance to turn to higher spiritual life. So, already we have gone through so many lives. Sakhalu, labdhalu, kathamanaya, vishayamagardushnaya, vanchita. We have been trapped or cheated or deceived by this desire for worldly comforts in all these lives. And again, I won't jump into that blazing fire of worldliness. Because all these worldly comforts may be real, but they are not eternal. So, every spiritual seeker who turns to higher spiritual life should always keep somewhere in the corner of his mind or remind himself of this fact that this world with all its comforts may be all right for the time being, but they are perishable, they are transitory, they are not eternal. So, the non-eternal nature, the transitoriness of all worldly comforts should be always a reminder that we should look for some higher purpose in life. Otherwise, what happens? We become a fuel. That's why Sakhalu Labdha Lokaka Katham Anaya Vishaya Magardushnaya Vanchitaka Tasseva Puna Pradiptasya Samsara Agnehi Atmanam Indhano Kuryam Iti. Otherwise, you know what happens? We become dry twigs which are thrown into this blazing fire of worldliness. So, in fact, it doesn't mean that we should become cynical or we should take a very cynical view, negative view of life or world. That's not what is meant by here, by these statements. Higher wisdom comes not when we run away from the reality of the world, but when we realize the limitation of all these worldly comforts. not when we run away from, but rather when we move towards a higher goal. So a positive movement towards a higher goal is much more important than moving away from something else. So that's the idea behind. So the comment in Kupiasa's commentary continues, which of course we don't have time to go through the whole commentary. It's an extremely philosophical commentary. So I mean, one point that strikes you as something very interesting is these commentaries do not present yoga as a world-negating or life-negating or highly negative way, philosophy of life with a strong emphasis on over asceticism. What it tells us is living this world, but there is a higher perspective, the higher meaning. So once we understand the limitation of these worldly pleasures, we don't need to run away, rather we take a higher view of the realities that we live with, in the midst of which we live our life. So that is the 52nd sutra. Now we come to the 53rd sutra. The 53rd sutra is very interesting. So because it tells us to develop discrimination, what we call discerning mind, by concentrating on each particle of time. I mean, okay, I explained this. Kshana tatkramayohu samyamadi vivekajnam jnanam. So sutra is the kshana tatkramayohu samyamadi vivekajnam jnanam. So by making samyama, so samyama we should know, it is a combination of the 6th, 7th, 8th steps of Ashtanga Yoga. So yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, samadhi. So dharana, dhyana and samadhi together are called samyama. Through samyama, we move towards a higher insight into whatever we are meditating upon. But again, as I mentioned earlier, Patanjali and also commentators laid down the central principle that any exercise of samyama, higher concentration, should be preceded by perfection in the practice of the 10 disciplines which are mentioned in the first and second stages of yoga. That means yama and niyama. Yama ahimsa satya asteya brahmacharya parigraha niyama sauja sandosha tapasya adhyaya isarbanidhana. That means non-violence, purity, complete freedom from possessiveness, greed, contentment, internal and external purity, chastity of life, and feeding our mind with higher thoughts all this time. And as a result of which, we get a kind of inner contentment, inner fulfillment. So these 10 disciplines are fundamental, and we should have fully established ourselves in these disciplines. If we have not fully established ourselves in these 10 disciplines called yama and niyama, we won't be able to withstand the temptations of using these supernatural powers for negative purposes or wrong purposes. So every time when you come across a newspaper report or anywhere where a spiritual teacher, after making some progress, there was an unfortunate downfall, it's always is linked to one central principle: lack of perfection in the practice of yama and niyama. That's possible only, first of all, if we practice kriya yoga, means tapasvadhyaya isapanidhanani kriya yoga, first sutra in this sadhana pada, it comes. We already discussed this many times, and you can read, you can listen to the previous classes, so we won't repeat them again now. So I shall read Swami Vivekananda's simple, straightforward translation and commentary on this sutra. That is, kshana tatkramayohu samyamadi vivekajam jnanam. So by making samyama on a particle of time and its precession and succession comes discrimination. The word discrimination here means a discerning mind, higher wisdom. That's the meaning of this word here, higher wisdom. How are we to avoid all these things? These devas means celestial beings, heavens and powers. See, reaching heaven is not in American language, not a big deal in yoga. It is a very, very insignificant. Rather, it is something undesirable. Because when you read this translation, you have to keep this important point in mind. Heaven, as understood in Christian theology, is different from the heavens that is mentioned here. So when you read translation, this should be kept in mind. See, in Christian theology, heaven has got a divine or spiritual significance. It is the abode of God, angels. It is a great achievement. It has something to do with spiritual perfection, spiritual achievement. But heaven, as mentioned in yoga translations, has got a totally different meaning. It's like a 6-star hotel, let us speak, where you enjoy all comforts without paying any rent, as long as you want. It is an extension of all humanly conceivable worldly enjoyments and pleasures. Nothing less, nothing more. That's the meaning of the word heaven as used in any book, or any translations or commentaries on yoga philosophy and yoga psychology. That should be kept in mind very clearly. So heaven in Christian theology has a divine, a spiritual significance, kingdom of heaven. So that is a divine, a spiritual goal for you. Get out of purgatory, you reach heaven, you are completely purified, when you lead a spiritual life, a pious life, you go to heaven. That's not what is implied by the word heaven in yoga. Here heaven means a place where you enjoy worldly comforts, that's all. As a result of some deeds you have done in this life with some desire. So you receive, you do something, you get a reward. It's like a salary or increment, that's all. That's what it means here. So that should be kept in mind when you read this translation. How are we to avoid all these things, devas, heavens and powers? By discrimination, which means by higher spiritual wisdom, by discerning mind, by knowing good from evil. Therefore, a samyama is given by which the power of discrimination can be strengthened. This is by making a samyama on a particle of time and the time preceding and following it. That means, when you fully understand the momentariness or the transitoriness, the non-eternal nature or the impermanence of all that you find by focusing on the smallest time unit in which it exists, then you realize its impermanence. That's also the principle in Buddhist philosophy. Both in the two schools of Mahayana system, I mean the Shunyavada, which is called the doctrine of whiteness of Nagarjuna, and also in the Vijnanavada, which is called Yogacara system, Vasubandhu, Dignaga and others, there's always a focus on the impermanence of phenomena, external and internal phenomena. So once you focus, you concentrate on the, what you call, kshana. So it's called kshanikavada, the school of kshanikavada, it is called. The doctrine of kshanikada, mean momentariness, which means they exist only for one moment. Not, it is in the preceding moment And also the following moment, succeeding moment, it changes. So everything is momentary or momentariness. So once you focus or do some yama on the momentariness or impermanence of things, when you realize the impermanence by focusing on the kshana, the smallest possible limit, unit of time, particle of time, then you develop higher wisdom. Because practically, the absence of wisdom is always linked to taking the unreal for the real and the real for the unreal. For example, this body, we know that this body is not permanent. Maybe the healthiest man live for 100 years. We know all that we possess, that we attain through our efforts at the empirical level, worldly level, are impermanent. In the sense they may not, they won't be there for all time. But still every moment we mistake and think that, we make a mistake and think that these things are eternal. Intellectually we know, but when we do things for a moment, the mind somehow deludes itself into thinking that these worldly comforts are there for all time. Intellectually we know, every person of average intelligence understands the impermanence of worldly comforts as a philosophy, as a doctrine. But when we get obsessed with that, when we get too much attached to it and go out of the way to spend our lifetime and efforts to acquire these worldly comforts, at that moment we forget. We allowed ourselves to be deluded into thinking that this world is real, for all time is eternal, worldly comforts are eternal, they are permanent. So we delude ourselves into thinking that the unreal is real and the real is unreal. So this problem can be countered by focusing on the smallest particle of time in which things exist. So we will continue this discussion in the next class. Now we will have interaction for about 10 minutes. So if you have anything to ask, most welcome.
So Swamiji, I would understand trying to avoid the temptations that we have so we don't fall off the spiritual path. I just wonder, what's the need for the temptations in the first place? Why do we have those in us? What's the necessity for the suffering? What's the necessity for those temptations to pull us away?
Yeah. So that's the nature of this world. It's a purely ontological question. Why should this world be there? So why should the earth be round, spherical in shape? So yoga tries to analyze the nature of life and the world and its phenomena and try to understand its true nature. The world by its very nature is like this. Of course, yoga and its allied system, Sankhya, together give a definite answer to this. So it takes us to the metaphysics of yoga, which is again the metaphysics of Sankhya system. Now, there are two fundamental categories in both yoga and Sankhya systems. One is Purusha, the other is Prakriti. Purusha is, it is consciousness itself. It is, its very nature is knowledge. And Prakriti is unconscious. So the whole creation is an evolute of Prakriti. Prakriti is the primary matter. That's we can translate it in English. So the entire empirical phenomena and also our mind, intellect, thoughts, our senses of action, senses of perception, in everything is an evolute of Prakriti. And they are always subject to changes. They don't remain the same. So from Prakriti, Mahatattvam evolved, from Mahatattvam, Ahankara, from Ahankara, Sattva Ahankara, in the Karmendriyas, Jnanendriyas, and mind, Tamasya Ahankara, Tanmatras, and the Pancha Mahabhudas. Like that, you know. So, Sankhya system, which provides a philosophical aspect to yoga. The yoga metaphysical philosophy is linked to Sankhya. He says, this world is nothing but the result of evolution of different things from Prakriti. The Prakriti is one eternal reality, like Purusha. By its very nature, it is Jada, it is unconscious. From this Prakriti, everything evolves. So they are not absolutely conscious entities. They are unconscious entities. We become aware of our true nature when we become aware of the impermanent nature. Remember, when we realize our impermanent nature, simultaneously we also realize our permanent dimension. When we realize the true nature of ignorance, which is responsible for all these, then we realize our true nature, because both go together. So to give an example, when you realize a thing for what it is, then your misunderstanding about it vanishes. Both are simultaneous experiences. Similarly, the human nature is that as it is, it thinks that it is this body, it is this mind, this intellect, and so on. It is a human nature. If you ask the question, why should human nature be so? Well, Vedanta can explain this, well, God one day create this world as it is. That's a simple way. But Vedanta doesn't say that, or yoga doesn't say. Yoga tries to look around and see the world and explain it in a very scientific, rational basis. Otherwise, there is a simple process. God created everything as it is. So your philosophy dies there. Logic also dies there. But Vedanta and yoga do not think along those terms. So these external phenomena constitute evolution of Prakriti. That by this nature. So how to get back to our real nature? That's the purpose of yoga. Even the greatest mystics also had this experience. The point is, the whole humanity can be divided into two groups. One small fraction, a group of mystics, or you may great wise men or wise women, who have realized their true nature by realizing the impermanence of this world. And the other, those who are convinced that this impermanent world is the permanent thing. There are two categories. So yoga is very rational. If you ask the question, Newton works of, why should there be gravitation? Newton didn't think of those things. Newton faced this problem, why apple fell on his head, if that story is true. So there should be a reason for it. Why should there be an apple tree? And why can't God, an omniscient God, omnipotent God, create this world minus gravitation? The apple would not have fallen on his head. So this problem can be answered by a single statement: God made the world the way it is. But that's not the way yoga and Vedanta approach this question. Yoga and Vedanta begin to analyze the effect and try to trace the inquiry, take the inquiry into the cause of it. But creationists begin with the cause and then explain the effect. Yoga and Vedanta, as modern science will do, try to focus on the effect and then will try to take you all the way to the cause. That's what science is all about. Isn't it so? Okay.
Namaste, Swami. I think this is related to both the question and the answer we just had. So can a normal human being achieve samadhi while having a life?
Yeah.
Is there a recent historical example of such a name or a person you can tell? Is a historical example of such a name who attained samadhi in his life?
You mean, well, I can give many examples. Perhaps closest to our own times, you can give the examples of maybe Ramakrishna Paramahansa, Vivekananda, Ramana Maharshi, and a few great mystics whose life I have read and teachings, and I found that they have reached the samadhi aspect. One important sign that the words contain wisdom is there is always a transcendental plane from where they speak and look at the world and its realities. There is always a coherence and a harmony. And again, to be frank, an extreme logic, rationality. So if you read the teachings of Sri Ramakrishna and the gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, you find he was not a student of philosophy. But in simple language, he tries to explain the deeper questions of life, spiritual life. Now, the most striking part of it is you cannot contradict it from logical point of view. So, some of the most straightforward spiritual truths are beyond logical analysis, really speaking. So, why the world should be what it is? You know, this question was put in one of discussions. Then the answer the person gave was, well, I forgot to ask that question to God. That's the answer. It comes in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. Now, that discussion is revealing because, really speaking, we can answer this question in a very simple way, but it will be contrary to logic. You won't be able to give proof to it. When God created this world on a particular day, he decided to do this. Now, if you ask what proof is there, you cannot give a proof. On the other hand, if you analyze the world as you experience, as you find today, and try to explain and analyze it on the basis of our own experience, there is always a logic. So spiritual truths go beyond logic, but will never be in conflict with logic. It will not contradict logic or reason, but it may transcend reason and logic. So that's the idea behind. Another thing, now we cannot really answer the question why the world should be what it is, because we are approaching this question with our mind, and our mind itself is part of this world. So we can approach this question only from a perspective that's higher than the question itself. A teacher should know little more than the student to be able to answer the student's question. So, with our present mind, we are trying to analyze a question that's really beyond mental analysis, intellectual analysis. That's the thing.
One question was that if we are trying to recognize beyond this world of Maya or whatever world that we are in, how do you go beyond this? Because in order to realize that, we have to go beyond this. But when we are thinking from this standpoint, how do we get to that point?
How do we
transcend beyond this Maya situation to realize that?
Yeah. Once we develop a strong desire for higher wisdom, that is called mumukshutam, or desire for liberation in Sanskrit is called. Once we develop a strong desire for higher wisdom, then we will find out a way. So a strong desire for higher wisdom itself will be able to give us a clue as to how to go around. Because when we develop a strong desire for higher wisdom, we automatically give up our desire for lower things. So our sense of priority also changes. That's why mumukshutvam is the last and most important criterion for every spiritual quest. The first one is a willingness to reject the unreal, the empirical, and aspire for the higher, the real, the first. The last one is a strong desire for liberation, mumukshutvam. Between these, there are two other factors, which are again related to renunciation or giving up lower things. So if you can develop a desire for higher wisdom, then it automatically opens many of our inner faculties of the mind for going for higher things. It really happens. And how to develop this higher thing? Well, yoga says and Vedanta say, either it may be due to your evolution from previous life, or sometimes some events or circumstances in this life itself, which may make us open the eyes to the grimness of certain truths. We may work hard for achieving certain things, or our mind may be attached to certain things or persons. Suddenly, we find the response or the result is just the opposite of what it is. Suddenly, you know, we find a kind of conflict. We did certain, we worked hard for certain things. We, with strong desire and earnestness, we worked. But we didn't get it. This is actually against logic. 2 + 2 = 4. But in life, 2 + 2 = not 4. It could be anything. In life, you do certain things with great effort. If it is logical process, then that effort should produce its logical result. It doesn't happen. Then people turn to yoga or higher things, really speaking. You see, that's the difference between a mechanical wisdom, intelligence, and maybe the most intelligent computer cannot be turned to yoga. It may commit an error. Because only enlightened human beings can turn to yoga. The question arises, why it is so? Why this logical fallacy? In physics or mathematics or in mechanics, if you put certain things input, the output and input should be there should be logical connection. We you help a person and the response is different. You work hard for certain things and the result is not the opposite. So this contradiction sometimes may open our eyes. Is there something higher than this empirical world, the worldly things? Then we may turn to higher wisdom. So people turn to prayer. That's the meaning of atha. The word atha is interpreted in such an elaborate way in many worldly scriptures. Now we turn to yoga. When we turn to yoga, when we really come face to face with the fallacy of worldly things, worldly logic, and then we look for something higher, look for an answer, we turn to yoga. That also can be a means for opening door to higher wisdom. But then this also doesn't happen unless you have prepared the ground, maybe in previous life. So, because everyone doesn't turn to yoga, some people turn to yoga. Yoga here should be understood in a broader sense, higher spiritual pursuit. That's what yoga literally means. Higher spiritual pursuit, looking for a higher meaning or relevance of life. That's a literal. If there's a literal meaning, yoga itself could be that. Yuj dhadu, the Sanskrit dhadu will give this very scientific meaning. So anything else? I'm happy this chapter is really not taken very seriously. We are dealing with the supernatural powers of practicing samyama, which is really not taken and studied very elaborately. That's why I skipped many of the sutras. But still, if it elicits so many inquiries, it's wonderful. Any more? Okay. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ram Krishna.